Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culloden.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Culloden, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Now, coming up on today's show, why do people not want to retire, and why do more men want to retire rather than women? We look at the complicated factors of working into your 70s. Now imagine being interviewed by an AI robot. In this month's Techscape slot, we talked to a journalist who was. Plus, Simon Cooper of the Financial Times tells us whether or not Donald Trump is actually a fascist. Now you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Culloden. Now, for my explainer this week, I saw something in the jobs report that came from the US. It was out last Friday, and it really caught my attention. The portion of US economic output that goes to workers in the form of wages and salaries has plunged to the lowest level on record in the third quarter of last year. Now, why did that catch my attention? Well, let me explain what it means. Imagine a country is 100 people in the population. Now, they could make money from working for a wage, but they could also maybe build a property and rent it out. Some might put their money in deposit and earn interest. Some could invest in stocks and generate gains and dividends from them. And then if you added up the whole lot, that is how you would calculate the country's income. In the US today, the portion that people are earning today from wages is at the lowest level on record, which points out that much of the income from the country is actually being earned from returns on investment. And this is the source of the K-shaped economy that you might be hearing about now. But what happens if you're not earning a lot of money? Well, then it's hard to get the money to invest to get those returns. And on the other hand, the more money you have and how you're investing it to get those returns, well, then the more money that you get. So this just highlights that the actual difference between two different factions of society in the US economically is at the greatest difference that it's ever been on record from the Bureau of Labour Statistics. And I just think that that's a really striking element. And it also leads us very well into the first discussion that we're going to have with our first guest today. So what does Donald Trump believe in? Many of his political opponents and a whole section of political commentary reach for the phrase fascist to describe both his beliefs and his methods. But is it that simple? In the last few days, Simon Cooper, author and columnist at the FT, has been writing about what underscores Trumpism, and he joins me now. So first off, Simon, I was interested in the piece that you had in the FT, and you started off by saying that you wanted to understand questions that were central to attempts to understand him. Is that even possible to understand President Trump?
Well, I mean, can we understand any human phenomenon? I think that after what he's been in power for nearly 6 years now in total, we have a very good grasp of Trump, and, you know, the inside of his mind is on the outside. So I don't think there's huge mysteries there. And, you know, we also have a lot of historical knowledge. And of course, the thing that people reach for first is fascism. And, you know, before I say exactly what I think he is, of course, he's a dangerous authoritarian. Whether or not you decide he's a fascist, he's a very, very dangerous man. We just need to understand better what type of danger it is.
Okay. Now, and you do arrive at a conclusion at the end of the piece, and we'll get to that. But first of all, if we can understand that term fascist, because I think it can be thrown around a little bit, and that's certainly something you allude to as well. But you also highlight that we can confuse fascism with Nazism, and that necessarily isn't a normal or a ubiquitous suggestion. So can you take us through what you believe fascism is?
Yeah. So when people think of fascism, they think, you know, of the very worst outcomes, the Holocaust and World War II. Now, that's only the final outcome of one brand of fascism, Hitler's. So Franco in Spain was a fascist, Mussolini in Italy was a fascist. Mussolini would not have started World War II. So, you know, fascism doesn't need that. And so when Trump's defenders say, oh, well, it's ridiculous to compare him to Hitler because of this, that's not quite what being a fascist needs to be. Now, what is a fascist? There's a lot of arguments about this, but Umberto Eco, the famous Italian scholar, wrote this wonderful essay 30 years ago called Urfascism. And Eco lived through Mussolini's Italy as a child. And he has this checklist of what fascism is. And if you look at what Trump does, Trump is just checking off Eco's checklist as to the methods. So Eco says fascists treat disagreements as treason. They lead a cult of action for action's sake. They tell supporters, well, your privilege is that you're born in this country and you must be afraid of intruders. And there's always a plot against us. So all this, of course, is just classic Trump. And sometimes word for word. So Eco says the fascist leader claims to speak for the people. And Eco says one day there's going to be a TV or internet populism in which the emotional response of a selected group of citizens can be presented as the voice of the people. So, you know, you read this and you think, yeah, I mean, Trump is exactly the kind of fascist that Eco had in mind 30 years ago.
Okay, now, just before we go any further, as I read through your article, I went and I read that essay, and I actually don't think one could fully understand your argument without reading it. And indeed, there was 14 points on that that he described. But one of them that stood out to me was actually less to do with the person in question and more to do with the group of people who might be electing this leader. And that is a frustrated middle class. I heard somebody say to me recently, one can't understand the rise of Donald Trump without understanding the rise of Bernie Sanders. And isn't there an understanding here, whether it is due to the K-shaped economy, whether it's to do with inequality, whether it's to do with people who feel that the real value of their wages hasn't risen in quite a period of time, that there is a frustrated middle class, certainly in America, but in many parts of the developed world?
Yeah, and I think middle class is an important word because it's often said that Trump speaks for the white working class, and they are part of his constituency, and only the white working class, whereas, of course, a lot of the American working class is not white. But Trump voters had higher incomes in 2016 than Hillary Clinton voters. So a very large part of them are people who are in the middle, and as you say, they feel they haven't done as well as they thought they would, and they also feel that the kind of historical status they enjoyed as being native-born Americans is under threat, and also native-born American men were supposed to have the highest incomes. That's not always true anymore. So it's not that these are people at the bottom mostly, it's these are people in the middle who feel threatened in their status.
Right. Therefore, they're looking for something else. And I would imagine that the idea then is that, well, look, the status quo hasn't worked for us. Let's try an alternative. And again, we could go to many other countries around the world where we could see that. Before we leave the Eurofascism essay, as I was reading through the checklist, like there was things like a rejection of modernism, heroism is the norm, a popular elitism, also newspeak, where there would be an impoverished vocabulary and an elementary syntax. Did you think that one could take an a la carte approach to this list and point out a fascist? Or do you think that one who would be called a fascist would need to be all 14 of these?
I think Eco says that fascist is all or almost all those things. I mean, of course, you know, a fascist is not something that can be identified in nature. You can't do a completely natural scientific approach. So you have to be a bit flexible and eras change. But there's one point in his list that, you know, we'll come to, but it's just totally not Trump. And so he says fascists have this cult of death where they valorize dead soldiers and they go on about that. And they so dying in war is the highest thing. And Trump doesn't have that at all. And, you know, this, I argue, is a key difference between Trump and Hitler, but also Mussolini and Franco. He doesn't have any interest in kind of soldiers' graves and the kind of thing you see in Russia now where they Russia is very close to a clear definition of fascism where they kind of bang on about the Russians who died in the heroic war for the fatherland against Nazi Germany.
Okay, and that seemed to be the turning point in your own piece, because then you read another piece which was called When Yesterday Knocks. And just before we go to that, though, I thought it was interesting that you said Trump doesn't go anywhere unless the country in question could never be able to defend themselves against the might of the US military. I'm paraphrasing you slightly, but the examples you gave were Venezuela, Iran, and potentially Greenland. Can you take us through your point of view on that? In the context of the fact that you say he doesn't glorify war.
I mean, he likes to attack countries and have quick wins, like in a kind of action movie. So you kidnap the Venezuelan president, but then you don't put any boots on the ground, which, you know, if you really want to secure Venezuelan oil for probably your own interests, because they've just set up a bank account in Qatar where a lot of the proceeds are going to go to, you would need to send American soldiers, some of whom could then be killed. He was, I think, genuinely against the wars in Iraq and Vietnam because he thought, you know, it's stupid. What's the point in dying? What he does like is you bomb another country, you look macho, but none of your own people get killed. So that's always the Trump mode of intervention. It's very brief. It's in and out.
And let's now go to the second half of your piece then, which was When Yesterday Knocks. It's, and now that's the English translation. It's a non-fiction book. It deals with the theme of history, but particularly its recurrence with your, with the past. And this is what changed your mind, isn't it? After you had read the previous essay that said it certainly had many parallels, or Trump's activities had many parallels with fascism. This one convinced you otherwise.
Yeah, so it's a German book, and that's Gestern Unklopft, which translates, as you say, When Yesterday Knocks. And it's collections of essays by mostly German, Dutch and American historians where they look at the 1930s and 40s and ask how much parallels apply to this day. And I found it fascinating. There were two essays that I thought were particularly helpful in understanding what Trump is. And one is by this guy, Thomas Weber, who's a German historian at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. And he says, look, if you look at Hitler's belief system and Trump's belief system, they're quite different. So I've said that I agree with Umberto Eco in a way that Trump's methods are very clearly fascist, and you see that in Minnesota now. But the belief system is not. So Hitler's belief was that, you know, you have this German folk, and it has to come together for the highest human purpose, that is waging war. And to do that, you need a very strong bureaucratic state, which, you know, builds the military machine and supplies it, and also does surveillance of the population all the time. And so what are we here for? Hitler would say, well, to make war. And Trump thinks war is stupid. He doesn't do this cult of heroic death. He only does bashing defenseless countries. And, you know, in his own life, nobody in his family has ever done military service. And he's called American soldiers killed in wars like World War One, he's called them losers and suckers, and said what was in it for them. So he thinks the highest purpose of human life is very different. It's self-enrichment. We're here to make money for me and my family, not for anyone else. And the one who makes the most money wins. And there shouldn't be any rules stopping you making money. So, you know, if you want to sell fake products or whatever, if you want to con people, that's all fine, like he did with Trump University. No rules. So he believes in this kind of extreme version of American capitalism without rules, that's about self-enrichment. And you see that, you know, his family has monetized the presidency. They've set up these crypto firms. They've issued these cryptocurrencies. And he's very unabashed. And I think the Venezuelan oil is the next unabashed step in that. He's got this plane from Qatar. Because he thinks, why should I be ashamed of it? It's natural. We're all here just to make money for ourselves and our family. Everyone would do it. And so his purpose, his belief in what we're here for, and Hitler's belief are just completely at odds with each other. And Thomas Weber says that makes it quite hard to see Trump as, you know, a replication of that 1930s fascism.
First of all, wouldn't it be intriguing to have Lyndon Johnson and Donald Trump in the same room? Where Lyndon Johnson was making those decisions to send more and more soldiers out into the Vietnamese War, understanding that there was no light at the end of the tunnel and what was coming along the way. And just, I would be intrigued to watch that conversation unfold with the type of emotive language that you mentioned. But can I go to the point that you make there about, that you make, but specifically Weber theorizes about Trump believing in neither state nor society, but instead, as you say, an extreme version of American capitalism. Do you think American voters voted for that?
I mean, Trump, of course, is a con man. He's a sort of carnival barker, the guy you know meet outside a 19th century carnival who says, you know, does your back hurt? Do you feel tired? I have some snake oil that will cure your problems. And of course, he said to voters, you know, I made my company rich, which is not actually true. It was more, he inherited money from his dad. And so I'll make America rich the same way. So his promise to them was, I will make us all rich, which he was never particularly interested in. And it was, of course, incredibly naive of people to believe that that's the way it works, that if somebody has made money in business, which Trump, of course, hasn't really, then, or he didn't until he started to monetize his presidency, then they can make money for the country. But that was his promise. So there was a conning of the voters. He didn't say, my goal in life is self-enrichment and that's how I will govern as well.
One could challenge that by saying American employment is up. Certainly sales of domestic goods as a result of the tariffs is up. One could also argue that the prices of things are up as well. There's been a serious commitment of capital from companies around the world that does look like it will happen. No, far less than he says, but when you look at the White House tracker, that's where I'm getting my numbers from there. Couldn't one argue that Make America Great Again is turning into some economic results in the US?
I don't think so. I mean, since the end of the financial crisis, the US came out of it much better than the Europeans. So under Obama, there was constant economic growth. So the two strongest rises in the stock markets are any US presidents were under Bill Clinton and then Obama. That growth continued under Trump one. It then obviously collapsed during the pandemic and then resumed. And now it's slowed, so employment growth is slowing, and tariffs hadn't had a huge effect, but they have been a bit negative, and there's a huge amount of investment going into AI, so it's a good historical moment. The White House tracker and all these pledges supposedly by, you know, the Japanese or the Gulf Arabs to invest in America are not to be taken at face value. I think the Europeans also said they would buy some incredible amounts of US goods. None of these are binding commitments. And it's what you say to Trump in a meeting, because that's what he wants to hear. So, you know, you say we're going to invest, you know, X hundred billion, and he goes away. And then, you know, if in a couple of years you haven't invested that, well, nobody is going to really be able to force you to do it.
Well, I'm going to finish by quoting your good self, Simon. And that is the last part of your piece. You conclude with, Trump resembles a pre-modern patrimonial leader from the era before the states. You say this is argued by Stephen Hansen and Jeffrey Copstein in another essay in that book. In other words, he is more an Iron Age chieftain than a fascist leading a modern state.
Yeah, so in fact, he's not very interested in a big state. Again, unlike Hitler or Mussolini, where the state is supposed to control everything, in that way, fascism is not totally different from communism, although it does leave room for companies, but they have to be under state control. And in fact, you know, Trump tasked Elon Musk to get rid of a lot of the state. So what is a patrimonial leader? What is an Iron Age chieftain, which is what Hansen and Copstein argue he is? If you think back, you know, thousands of years, you'd have this clan that would be led by the big man, and he rules with his extended family, you know, so the family does the main jobs. And the big man, the patrimonial leader, would meet the leaders of rival clans one-on-one and do sort of personal deals with them. And that's sort of a reasonable description of the Trump presidency. So you have, you know, the sons run the business. The son-in-law, Jared Kushner, flies around doing these supposed peace negotiations. It's very much a kind of family operation without the state. He's not so interested in the state most of the time.
It has been fascinating to talk to you, Simon. It really has. And thank you very much for bringing both sides of that argument to the conversation and also to the article. Thank you indeed for joining Taking Stock. Simon Cooper, author and columnist at the FT. This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. After the break, we look at a very different AI future of job hunting. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Now for my trivia this week. Well, there was a lot of talk last year about the Mag 7, including on this show. And the Mag 7 are the seven big tech companies in the US. My question to you is, do you think you would have had a better return by investing in the Mag 7 in the US or the largest seven companies in the Irish stock market? Have a think about it, and I will give you the answer at the end of the show.
Techscape on Taking Stock with the all-new Renault 4. Stylish and versatile. A high-tech take on the classic. Rethink Renault.
Well, job interviews are often a necessary part of getting a job, and it can be daunting to face an interview panel of three people you've never met before who can determine whether you get the job of your dreams and or an income that determines your living standards for the foreseeable. However, maybe the rules of engagement have changed completely with the AI interview. Helen Coffey, Senior Features Editor of The Independent, joins me here at Taking Stock. First of all, Helen, can you begin by telling our listeners who Carl is and the role he played in your life recently?
Yes, indeed. I mean, Carl, I have to say, I named him myself. I named Carl. He was my job interviewer, and I sort of want to put job in inverted commas, because it wasn't a real job I was going for, and thank goodness. But Carl was my AI job interviewer. So he looked like a man, he talked like a man, but he was most definitely not a man. He was an AI interface designed to look like a human being.
Well, Helen, can I actually tell our listeners exactly the way you described Carl? You said he was nothing more than a soulless, if sophisticated, checklist of keywords and phrases fronted by an avatar in the guise of a handsome, ethnically ambiguous youngster.
Yes, indeed. I mean, should I have said he was handsome? I thought he was handsome. I think they're always designed to look quite nice, aren't they? I haven't seen an ugly AI yet.
Well, you seem to have quite the portfolio of experience the way you're talking.
No. I'm just going on the ones I've seen sort of, you know, on adverts and the telly.
And what was it like then in terms of the way in which you might have built rapport with who is now christened Carl? How did you interact with him? Did he respond to you?
It was really strange. It was, you know, they call that experience often with AI and other tech in that area, this experience of uncanny valley, which is like, it seems really close to being human, but there's something about it that isn't human. And that's very unsettling for us. And I think it's particularly heightened in a job interview where you're already nervous and you're relying on the fact that you're trying to build a bit of human connection. Yes, you're showing off your competencies, your experience, but what you really want to do underneath that is convince this other person, you like me, I'm the person for this job, you're going to work well with me. And kind of going into it knowing that you can't do that is already difficult, but then even things like someone's expression not really changing as you give an answer, you know, not getting that kind of eye contact where you really feel like something you've said has landed and they're like, yes, absolutely. Because he doesn't really know what you're saying. It's unsettling, I would say.
Well, when it comes to a job interview, like we think about, say, building rapport with a person, maybe establishing something that one might have in common, being able to talk through your answers, like tell me about a time that you had to work in a team or in an unfamiliar situation or had to resolve conflict, etc. How did you determine how to do well in this interview with the AI? Because you can't quite have the chats, or can you?
No, I mean, I assume it's been given quite, you know, probably quite a complex structure that it's working with lots of prompts, but it's kind of filtering. It's, you're trying to beat the algorithm is how I felt. You know, you want to be giving this answer that's got the right kind of jargon, the right kind of words, because it's just cross-referencing the data that's been input by whoever the recruiter is. You know, you can't make him laugh. He's not going to get kind of specific context or gist. And so I could really also see during that process why it would be very tempting to try and cheat and to get, for example, ChatGPT to kind of give you a really good answer based off your CV and just read that out. Because I felt constantly like I was going to get it wrong, you know, like I wasn't going to get these, you know, unbeknownst to me, words on a checklist that might make Carl think, oh, yes, she knows she can go through to the next round.
Was this an experiment, by the way, or is this a company that is actually providing this service to HR departments in the UK or beyond?
Yeah, this is a real company called Test Gorilla, and they invited me to try it. They've already got, they said, nearly 800 organisations have signed up to one of its plans that includes this specifically conversational AI interview tool. So this is already happening. It's already been rolled out. We're only going to see more of it. And that's kind of why I wanted to try it, because I think especially young people going up for a job now, there's every chance they will get through an entire interview process. And until right at the very end, they won't have interacted with a single human being at whatever company they've applied to, which is kind of really scary, or is from my perspective.
Well, I had to smile. Well, I smiled many times during the piece, Helen, but one of them was where you said, I can tell his heart's not really in it. After all, he doesn't have a heart.
Exactly. How can you win him over?
That's it. Now, if we look though more broadly at the world of AI and its role in recruitment, many, many, many companies are now using AI for screening in the first instance, which is rather than a human set of eyes looking at a CV, an AI is doing it. And one was guessing, because I don't know how the algorithm would be built, but one is guessing that the AI is looking for certain terms, or is it making a more nuanced review of the CV? Like, if somebody today is starting off in the workforce and let's say that they don't have a lot of work experience or they're trying to make themselves stand out, do they now have to like search what is the most searched or looked for terms from an AI algorithm as opposed to, well, what skills are in most demand in the workplace today?
Yeah, I think so. And that is already happening, which is the real problem in recruitment, because what's been created is what I see as a sort of AI arms race. You know, everyone is trying to get step ahead recruiters on one side and candidates on the other. And so candidates are naturally thinking, oh my gosh, well, if AI is going to be screening me, I should use AI to do the application because A, it's going to be faster and I can apply to more jobs more quickly. And B, AI is going to know how to beat AI. Now, it'd be fine if not every single other competitor you're up against were doing the same thing. So we've got this situation where, you know, it's not recruiters' fault necessarily because they are, you know, drowning under a deluge of applications. But then how on earth do you differentiate when every application is getting more and more similar because it's all written by AI? How do you pull one out?
Well, you know, what used to be a thing that recruiters always looked for was as perfect or at least close to perfect punctuation and grammar. Whereas actually now, if one makes a mistake in that, it shows that it's at least human-like unless you tell the AI to do it. It's as if we've come full circle on what good looks like.
Yeah, I think what's going to happen probably is some company will come in and rebrand and say, oh, we're doing, you know, human recruitment with the human touch. And they suddenly go, we only get human recruiters and we only accept applications that have been written by people and we've got advanced software to make sure that happens because it can't go on like it is at the moment. Because all that it means is that no one's having a good time of it, essentially. Job hunters aren't and the people hiring aren't either. So it's kind of, you know, locked.
Well, let's look at what, when you say the way it's going at the moment, let's look at what that is. You had quoted this from the AI in Hiring report. Job applications have surged by 239% since ChatGPT's launch, with the average job opening now receiving 242 applications. That's nearly triple 2017 levels. And that's according to recruiting software companies Greenhouse's 2025 AI in Hiring report. So for those companies that are either using an AI screener and then humanly interviewing people or else doing a human review on the whole process, is this exhausting them?
Yes, I would definitely say yes. I mean, there's been some stats about how recruiters feel so much more burnt out than they did, you know, 5 years ago because their whole job has changed. Because even if you want to kind of keep it a human approach, how on earth do you go through? I mean, often you're sort of trying to look at CVs on top of your regular job. I've certainly been in that position before, and you don't have time as it is. And if you're suddenly getting hundreds to look through, it's really difficult. It's really difficult. And I don't sort of blame anyone for trying to take a shortcut or use a screening tool to help. But the difficulty is, as we all know, humans are really complex, and often the best candidate for the job, they're not necessarily the person who on paper is perfect. That the person who comes in and wows you because you have the potential to be wowed, you know.
And when you say about how people can feel when it comes to being getting this deluge of applications, the reality is that is making an impact as well. Just to give you another figure that you had mentioned in your own piece, the number of applications making it to hire stage has subsequently dropped by 75%. I'm sure, Helen, you know people the same way I do who go through the soulless, torturous process of dealing with rejection after rejection after rejection if they get an acknowledgement at all of a job application when they're looking. And it's an emotional process that can be very, very hard to take. So is it the fact that this process now where people are using AI to customize cover letters and, you know, dramatically increase their productivity, it's actually leading to it being harder for everybody in the long run?
Yeah, I would 100% say yes, because it's always been difficult to apply for jobs and not get jobs. But I think it's so soul destroying at the moment to, you know, people are doing mass applications because they feel like they have to and they're desperate. But equally, I mean, I would definitely have this feeling of if a human has never looked at my CV or my cover letter or my application and I never get an interview, I just don't trust the screening tools necessarily, you know, but you feel really, really out of control as the person trying to get a job because you have no idea what their criteria is.
Well, Helen, since you've shared it first with us in your AI journey, being interviewed by an AI for the first time, I want to share one with you. And that is, this week I built my first superhuman agentic AI. And I went through the process of talking to it about a problem that I was having from a productivity perspective that I typically would tell a staff member, and then we would write a policy and then they would go and implement it and take it from there. And now the super agent is doing it instead. Yes, right. And the reason I'm bringing this up is you brought up the word trust. Now, if you had said that I would be doing this time last year, I'd say I don't trust an AI to go in and to act like a staff member within our own company from the perspective of delivering real productivity. And I would have held back from agentic AI, whereas now I'm gone over the fence in that regard. As you look at developments in AI in general, do you see us creating more and more trust in AI? Whether it might be to write our CV, write our cover letter, in fact, interview people to come into our companies. Is that where you see us going as a race?
I think in the short term, that is what's going to happen, because it's kind of already happening. And, you know, people have made the good point that you can at least with AI. AI does have bias because it's often based on us, but you can go in and systematically kind of try and amend for that bias and say, no, don't do that. And that happens across the board with your AI, rather than if you've got a kind of biased recruiting team, which is, you know, much more difficult to go in and train those people and actually have those difficult conversations, because humans are not perfect either. So there is an argument to say that AI in the long run could be more fair when recruiting. But I do think there will be at some point a kind of pendulum swing the other way, because, you know, as we know, workplaces aren't just, we're not robots. We're not going in soullessly getting the job done. They're this complex culture of different personalities. And that is part of hiring, is figuring out whether that kind of person will come in and add or take away from that culture that you've created. I don't think it can just be done on data and stats.
Well, the big question that I want to finish on today is, would you, Helen, hire Carl to do that job for you if you were running a business?
No.
Well, you know what? Carl isn't going to be all that disappointed, because, as you told us, he doesn't have a heart. So exactly. We could break that news to him gently. Helen, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much indeed for joining me. Helen Coffey, Senior Features Writer of The Independent.
Thanks so much.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the not retiring movement. Welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. It seems the economics of apprenticeship is something many of you were interested that we had on the show last week, and certainly you feel it's not being discussed enough. Rachel Tuberty from PeopleSource shared this on LinkedIn. She said, if you're assisting students at home with completing their CAO forms over the coming weeks, perhaps give this radio discussion on News Talk a listen first. And I also had a message from Kevin in Austin, Texas, a loyal listener from around the world, who was reflecting on the role work experience had in getting an internship in the US. So just interesting that a range of you have been sharing your reflections with us on that. And we love hearing from you. So please do keep comments coming to us. Now, almost one in five workers in Ireland believe that they will have to keep working until they are 70 just to afford to retire, or because they want to. This is one of the findings from a new retirement age financial feasibility survey from Royal London Ireland. Rising living costs, housing and gaps in pension savings are all playing a role, while more people, especially women, say they may never fully retire at all. So what are people to do, and how can we best prepare for the uncertainties that later retirement brings? We're joined now by Claire Barrett, who is the consumer editor for the Financial Times, and Jennifer Loftus, Group and Chief Actuary at Acorn Life Group. Claire and Jennifer, you're both very welcome, and thanks so much indeed for joining us. Jennifer, I'm going to start off with you. When we talk about retirement these days, could you give us a sense of what people think about, economically or otherwise? What comes to mind when they're thinking about retirement now?
Hi, Susan. I think it depends on their stage of life. I think if you're in your 20s or 30s, it's still a really abstract concept. It's hard to imagine retirement. It's really hard to visualize it. It's just not real. But I think as you get older, I think we're very much anchored to the concept of age 65. As our normal retirement age. And I think maybe we need to be a bit more flexible around that. That's actually just, it's a social construct, and it's around for years at this stage. And if you think about it, when we started to define normal retirement age as 65, the life expectancy at that stage was actually an awful lot shorter. You're probably talking about 12 years for men and women on average. And now you're looking at about 20 years if you make it to 65. So I do think we need to be a bit more flexible about how we define normal retirement age. The state pension kicks in at 66. That's still very much anchored to this concept of 65 as a normal retirement age. And if you think about it, people's needs are different. They change. some people may want to work after 65. Some people may want to work on a part-time basis after 65. Some people don't want to work at all. They might want to finish a lot earlier than 65. And, you know, health also plays a big part in this in terms of your ability to do your job or to do some sort of a job. So I do think we just need to be a lot more flexible around the definition of normal retirement age. But for younger people, I do think we need more education and awareness around retirement and making it a bit less of an abstract concept.
Claire, I am one of those people who would love to keep working forever. I love what I do and I'm very fortunate to do it. And Taking Stock listeners hear that on many occasions. However, if we do look at understanding people's retirement patterns, I'm going to quote you on a piece that you wrote last May about this. And you said, and you respectively were quoting, Webb and researchers at the University of Bath have analysed 50 years worth of pensioner spending data in a report called Downhill All the Way. Mm-hmm. The biggest predictor of retirement spending patterns was whether you are renting in retirement or own your own home. If I pick up on the point there that Jennifer made about younger people do feel owning their own home is out of reach. And is that part of the reason then that the sense of having a retirement is also an abstract concept, because home ownership could be too?
Well, absolutely. And all of the big studies in the UK that predict how much will you need in order to retire, they all assume that you won't have any meaningful housing costs after a certain age, because you would have not only got on the property ladder, but you would have cleared your mortgage by the time you reach the age of 65 or whatever the age is that you're targeting this idea, this concept of retirement, because I do think that it's changing fast. So, of course, you may not have paid off your mortgage by then, because people are buying homes later and later, obviously taking on bigger debts. The debts are being stretched out for longer, so we pay more interest to the banks over that time. They take us longer to pay them down and clear. So yes, absolutely, for the younger generation, this is going to really, really change retirement. But then for the Gen Xers, those who are currently aged sort of like 45 to 60, they were able to get on the property ladder in greater numbers when prices were more affordable. And for them, I think property is going to be a crucial factor in whether they can retire or not. Because if you haven't saved or invested enough, if your company pension is not as generous as you were expecting, because that's really been the big change in the last two generations, that what company pensions provide for their employees is massively, massively less now. Unfortunately, lots of people don't find that out until they get near to retirement age. But if you are in that Gen X group, it could well be that you own your own home outright. And not only does that mean you've got no living costs, no meaningful living costs going forward, you still want to maintain the property, of course, but you may also be able to do things like equity release and take some of the money out of your property to live on. It means that your children will inherit less when your time comes, of course. But for more and more people, that's becoming one of the key planks of how they are going to afford to support themselves when they either choose or are no longer healthy enough to keep working.
The other thing too, though, Claire, of course, is what has gone away is the defined benefit opportunity for a pension in an occupational pension. Like, to a large degree now, I don't know of any company that is offering a DB scheme as distinct to a defined contribution. And that, of course, has changed the expectation, literally, of what people can earn.
Yeah. Could I just translate that a little bit for people? So we talk about defined benefit pensions. They're also called final salary, gold-plated pensions. The whole idea in yesteryear of a pension is that when you stop work, every year until you died, you would get some money. Whereas now we have what's called defined contribution. You work, you pay into a pension, your employer is mandated to pay into that pension too, but at the end of the day, you have a pot of money, which is finite. It can run out and you have to make all of the choices about where that money is invested and look after it, see if you need to pay in, how much it's growing. So all of the responsibility is shifted from the company to the individual. But I think most people walking around on the street don't quite realise that.
Well, if we look into what most people on the street don't realise, Jennifer, many of them will know now that we've got auto-enrolment in Ireland, but what they may not realise is, of course, that they can opt out, or there could be an awful lot going on in the background that auto-enrolment ties into that whole idea of people setting and forgetting. We are at the very beginning of our journey on this in Ireland. How do you think auto enrollment is going to work out for the 30s and 40s age group as they get to their retirement years and years to come?
I think auto enrollment is a positive development, Susan, for a number of reasons. So first of all, it'll obviously increase pension coverage across the population. Whether it increases pension coverage by enough to ensure that people have a decent standard of living in retirement, I'm not sure, but it's certainly a positive move in that direction. I also think it's important culturally, though, in terms of signalling the importance of saving for retirement. I think as a country, we're probably not great in terms of that education and awareness piece. I remember chatting to a friend of mine a couple of years ago who grew up in America. Now, she's been living in Ireland for the past 20 years, and she was talking about, you know, preparing for retirement and how it was always very much on her radar, the importance of that. And she mentioned the fact that, you know, growing up in America, she was aware of the importance of a 401k from when she was in elementary school. It was absolutely ingrained in citizens in America from a very, very young age. And I don't think we've been great at that, but I do think auto-enrollment is definitely a step in the right direction in terms of that culture and the signalling and raising awareness and putting this on people's radar.
Claire, the Chinese say if you want to know the road ahead, ask those coming back. And automatic, that's what you called it, automatic enrolment was introduced in the UK in 2012.
It was.
How, now that you're into your 14th year of it, how do you find it has made a difference around all of the things that Jennifer referred to there? Pension coverage, awareness, even its cultural understanding.
I mean, overall, it's been massively successful. It's dragged about 11 million people, maybe more than that now.
Dragged, Claire. Dragged
savings.
Them. Wow.
whether they like it or not. Because the fact is, well, people like to use the term nudge. Now, if you've got to make an active decision to opt out of something, it's actually quite hard to do. You've got to be quite motivated. But this is the problem when pensions were the other way around and you had to make an active decision to opt in. So I didn't opt in. This is pre-auto enrollment. I didn't opt into the pension in my first job in journalism. And one of the reasons was there were rules then that meant if you had to stay at the company, I think, for like more than 2 years, otherwise you wouldn't have built up any benefits. And as a young flibbity gibbet, I thought, oh, well, I probably would have moved on and got a different job by then. Well, actually, it turned out I ended up staying at that company for 7 years. So I worked out what it could have cost me opting out of that pension. And probably in like hard cash terms, you know, we're talking about, you know, tens of thousands of pounds. But when you consider what that money could have done if it had been invested tax-free and growing and compounding, you know, you're getting growth on the growth in a pension fund over the years. By the time I retire, you know, that could have been a six-figure sum. So this is the big secret to auto-enrollment. By getting people young, even if it's a small amount of a contribution that's going in from themselves and their employer, it is something that can grow and compound over time. The lessons that Ireland can learn from the mistakes that we've made with auto-enrollment, because believe me, there have been many, is the whole administration of it, the back end. The average person in their life, I think, has about anywhere between sort of 8 and 11 jobs. If you've got a separate pension pot from each one, which is what people are now contending with, how do you keep track of them all? It's taken us ages to come up with this idea of the pensions dashboard. It's been spoken about for nearly as long as I've been covering pensions at the FT, and it still isn't with us. So thinking about the technology and how easy you make it for people to really look at and understand their pensions. I mean, some young people I know who do like fixed term contracts and move jobs a lot, you know, they're in their 30s and they've got 20 separate pension accounts, many of them with the same big pension provider, but actually being able to put them all together into a meaningful pot is too hard. So, you know, we really need to help people. Getting them saving is brilliant, but helping them focus on growing that pot and legislating so that it's easier for people to do that, that's the kind of stage that we're at now.
I so often say managing your money often has very little to do with the money and more with the management of it. Jennifer, I have to talk to you about one of the several of the key points that fall under one theme in this report. The pension pay gap is now 35%, which means that for every euro that men are generating after retirement, women are generating 65 cents. Almost half of men, 48%, believe they will retire before 66, compared to just 30% of women. And women are more likely than men to say they never want to fully retire, with 15% expressing this view, compared with 10% of men. What is the root, apart from the income pay gap, what is the root of such disparity?
Yeah, the gender pension gap is very concerning, Susan. So the main drivers really are around taking time out, unpaid leave during your career, during which time you're maybe not making contributions into your pension, or you're making lower contributions into your pension. But women are more likely than men to work part-time at various stages during their careers. They're more likely to take unpaid leave. Lots of women who take maternity leave are not paid during that period, apart from social welfare. And all of these factors mean that for periods of time during a woman's career, either pension contributions are lower than they would have been, or there's a pause where no pension contributions are being made. So there's an obvious impact in terms of future pension fund if the amount going into a fund is lower. But crucially, women are also missing out on the compounding effect of investment return over what can be quite a long period of time. If you think about, say, women taking time out during their 30s, for example, to look after children.
Or, of course, an older parent as well, for any side.
But there are a number of reasons. So, you know, caring for older parents is another reason why women might take time out. Mm-hmm. But if you think about the kind of the most common time when women would take time out, that's kind of around their 30s or 40s. And they're actually potentially missing out on 20 to 30 years of investment return and the compounding effect of investment return. And that's absolutely critical in terms of the size of the final pension pot, but also in terms of eroding the impact of inflation between your 30s and your ultimate retirement age.
Now, I know as well, we do have to factor in here that we're talking about an emotional topic when we talk about taking time out either to care for children or to care for elderly parents. I'm sure there's many people listening today who do that and feel that it's a privilege to be able to do that and might feel that we're being crass in our conversation. But it is a conversation that needs to be had. And there, we also need to look at what underpins such a big differential. And of course, how either as a society or as a household, we might want to deal with that. Thank you so much indeed to both Claire Barrett, who is the consumer editor of the Financial Times, and Jennifer Loftus Group and chief actuary at Acorn Life Group. Fascinating conversation. Really appreciate your time to both of you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Susan.
Now for my trivia this week. Well, there was a lot of talk last year about the Mag 7, and that's the seven big tech companies in the US. My question to you is this. Do you think you would have had a better return by investing in the Mag 7 in the US or the largest seven companies in the Irish stock market? So let's say you had 7,000 euro and you put 7 grand into the Mag 7 in the US. In comparison, you put 7 grand into the Irish, the top seven largest companies in the Irish stock market. Well, actually, for a start, if you were to compare like for like, you would have been better off in the Irish stock market because the Mag 7 was up about 25%, but the Irish stock market of those seven stocks actually outperformed much more significantly. But there's another element to it. Because you would have invested in the Mag 7, you'd have had to buy dollars. And since the dollar weakened, your return would actually have been lowered even further. Therefore, the answer to my trivia is you would have been better off investing in the Irish stock market in comparison. And this isn't just an Irish story, in fact. Several of the European markets delivered better returns than the Mag 7, despite the amount of headlines that they got. So let's see what unfolds this year. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app. And make sure and download the Go Loud app to hear all shows on this fantastic station. Of course, Taking Stock is also out on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. And the producer is indeed the erstwhile John Fardy. And on research this week were Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And already, I'm looking forward to talking to you again next week.